we go. Okay, we are live. So everyone, I want to welcome everyone who's joining us as we embark on our journey to learn through Maseches Makos. I know it was advertised as Maseches Makot, but you'll forgive me that I have an Ashkenazi accent, so hopefully we'll bear with that. But this is the plan. The plan really is there's 24 blots, which means two-sided pages, and we're doing only one side. We're doing an amud each week, one side of a page. So that means 48 weeks, which means in around this time of year, next year, God willing, we will be completing an entire Masechta of Talmud together, which is a remarkable accomplishment. Now, I know everyone is about to start clapping. We haven't gotten there quite yet, but we're starting the journey tonight. And this is really the method that I'm planning on using. Unlike some of my other classes where there's a source sheet and I guide us through it, I really want to keep the video on so I could see everyone as we're learning. So what I did was I provided two links in the chat, which I think will be helpful. I mean, number one, for those who saw the emails, if you have your own Gemara, your own Talmud with you, all the better. But if not, the first link is Sefaria, which has the text in Hebrew, in Aramaic, Hebrew, and English in it. So that's the first link. The second link is a link to a website called Hebrew Books, which has a PDF of what the actual page of the Gemara looks like in a traditional Tzura Sadaf format. That's what I'll be referring to. So if I'm saying, you know, we're three lines down from the top, I'm referring to the page you can see in the second link over there. But I'll try to reference for anyone, depending on what you're following on, to make it as clear as possible. So just any questions on the logistics of accessing the links or anything? Is that all usable? Tested it out.
Where are the links again?
They're in the chat. Can you see it there?
I see the chat. I don't see any links in the chat.
You know what? So I think it might be in the chat sometimes that if I posted it too early, you might not see it. So let me read.
There it is. Now I see it.
Okay. So I think I posted it toward the beginning of the meeting. So that's why if anyone came a second afterwards, they missed it. So there you go. The first one is the first one's a PDF. The second one is Sefaria. So you could follow along with whichever one you like. We're going to translate and explain everything. But if you want to have English, yeah, Toby?
And can you use the art scroll?
By all means, you can use the art scroll. I'm not assuming everyone has a full set of art scroll in their house, but if you have an art scroll, that's helpful too. The only reason I'm saying this is I'm going to translate everything in a moment, but the idea of this class based on our survey is that I'm assuming that the average person here has opened up a Gemara in their life before and has a general familiarity, even if they can't translate any of it. But also I want to try to be accommodating to those who are trying to learn Gemara for the first time. So what I want to actually do is screen share just for the benefit of those who are joining for the first time to try to orient us. So for those who are already familiar, you'll just indulge me for a minute or two. So what you're looking at over here is the link for the Hebrew books. This is the beginning of Makos. And what we're going to be starting off with is we plan to cover this whole page today. Now, it looks daunting, but when you think about it, we're actually only covering this part of the page. The rest of it is commentary. So the beginning is going to start off with a Mishnah, which is a early rabbinic text codified in about 200, around 200 in the Common Era. And then a few hundred years later, the Gemara, which you see Gemara for short over here, that is going to be the commentary, the elaboration on the Mishnah. So many times you could almost think about it as when you learn Bible, you study Chumash, you have the Chumash, and then you have Rashi commenting on it. So that's what the Mishnah here is, and then the Gemara comments. And then on top of that, if you look here on the side, we're not really going to look at it inside so much because we're trying to cover ground. We're not spending too much time, only one session on each Amud. On the right over here is Rashi, who is similar to how he's very helpful in understanding Chumash. He's also very helpful in understanding what the Gemara has to say. And then also there is Tosos on the side, which is even deeper commentary. So I might throw in a few things. I'm definitely going to say Rashi while I'm explaining things, and I might throw in Tosos, but we're not going to be looking at that inside so much. So this is the general format of the daf. There's Beis Amud Aleph right over here. So when you go to the next page, you'll have two dots like a colon to show Beis Amud Beis, which is page two, it starts on page two. It doesn't start on page one. Page two, side number two. So we're going to do only one side of the page today. So now that's what the Gemara has to say. So I'm hoping everyone is able to access the link at this point. And now I just want to give a conceptual introduction to Makos before we jump into the Mishnah. Or we'll look at the first few words in the Mishnah. So the Mishnah starts off, which is right at the beginning, the first words, Ketzad ha'edin nasin zomimin. How is it that witnesses could get a status of becoming perjurious witnesses? So there is a verse in the Torah. I think for those who are in our Sunday morning Chumash class, we actually saw this in a Rashi recently in our class, where we talked about Edim Zomimin. So Edim Zomimin are witnesses that they come to court. They say, for instance, Reuven owes Shimon $200. And then another pair of witnesses comes in and they say, how can you testify that Reuven owes $200 to Shimon? You were with us in California when you claimed this business transaction took place in New York. Now, they didn't have Zoom back then. So if you were with us on that day, you could not have seen it happen. So when the second pair comes in, they are mazim, the first pair, and they prove that they are perjurious witnesses. And under the right circumstances, what happens is, instead of Reuven having to pay the $200 that he doesn't owe any longer, these false witnesses pay the $200 to Shimon instead. Or similarly, if the witnesses said that Reuven committed a sin that would incur makos. Now, what does makos mean? Now we get a definition. Makos means lashes. That certain sins are so terrible that one incurs lashes for committing them. So if they come in, they falsely say, Reuven committed X sin, and he now incurs lashes. Reuven is, instead of Reuven getting the lashes, when these witnesses are proven to be false witnesses, they get the 39 lashes instead. So that's what's special. That's what's unique about Edim Zomim. They basically take on the punishment that they attempted is a key word. They attempted to mete out falsely to somebody else. So now it's important to keep this in mind because our Mishnah doesn't start off by giving us a classic example of Edim Zomimin, perjurious witnesses, but rather what it's going to do is it's going to give us two exceptions to the rule, which the Gemara is going to be as confused as we are, because why would the Mishnah start with two exceptions to the rule instead of first establishing the rule like we just explained? So what are these two exceptions? Let's take a look in the Mishnah. So Ketzada Edim Nasim Zomimin. How do witnesses get charged as Edim Zomimin, as false witnesses? One example is Me'idin anu bish ploni shehu ben grusha o ben chalutza. So let's say these two witnesses come in and they say that ploni, that Reuven is a son of a kohen who married a divorcee or married a chalutza. So the halacha is that someone who is of kohen, of priestly lineage, he is not supposed to marry a grusha, a divorcee. The halachic ramifications of that is that if he marries a divorcee and they have a child from that union, the child is called a chalal, which means that he loses his kohen status. He's not able, for instance, to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. He's not able to duchen, do birchas kohanim on the holidays. He basically, for all halachic intents and purposes, loses his kohen status, because kohanim are not permitted to marry a divorcee, a grusha. And also, for those who are with us for the Sunday morning class, who could tell us what chalitza is? We have a few Sunday morning rep. Okay, I'll spare you. Don't worry. So chalitza. Oh, we got Toby. Toby, are you volunteering?
It's the ceremony of the spitting into the shoe for a person who does not want to perform yibum.
Ah, very good. So now I have to back up and define yibum. So very quick tangent. So let's say a man passes away. He leaves a wife and a brother in this world. There's a mitzvah of yibum for his brother to marry his wife and have a child through that union, because he wasn't able to leave a child in this world. Now, as you can imagine, among all many other things, it could be kind of awkward, and for any reason, they might not want to get married to each other right after their brother/husband passed away. So they have an out called chalitza. Chalitza is like a pseudo-divorce because they're sort of connected to each other after their brother passed away. They're supposed to get married to each other, but they choose not to. So going through this chalitza process on a rabbinical level, it's viewed as divorce. And since a Kohen is not allowed to marry someone's divorce, and having a child of that union renders that person pasul l'kahuna, they are no longer considered a Kohen. So okay. Now I would think...
I witnessed chalitza.
Oh, really?
I was a witness to the performance of this mitzvah.
So it's a very odd kind of mitzvah. Like it's the boot, you take off the boot and you spit. It's a very odd ceremony. So we spent a lot of time in our Sunday morning class getting into the halachos. So I have to talk to you after the shiur. You'll give me more insight into it. But today we only do chalitza. We don't do yibam except for some svardim. But for the most part, Ashkenazim don't do yibam automatically, even if both the woman and the man want to do that. But anyway, that's all to say, if you were to ask me, okay, now we understand how Edom Zomimin work. Edom Zomimin, they get whatever they attempted to mete out. Whatever they falsely accused that person of, they get that punishment instead. So I would think it's logical that if they accused Reuven, not accused, but they just stated, they testified, it's not an accusation really, but they testified that Reuven is a chalal, he's a son of this union, and they're trying to take away his Kohen status. If they were Kohanim, they should lose their Kohen status because that's what they tried to mete out to him. That's what would be logical. However, the Mishnah tells us, we do not make them b'nei grusha or b'nei chalutza. They would not lose their Kohen status in return, but rather we give them a generic punishment, which is 30. It says 40 lashes, but really it's later on we'll talk about it. It's really 39 lashes. They get 39 lokas, the word, same word as makos. So now we know why this Masechta is Makos, because it talks a lot about the punishment, Makos. So Makos
is... Who does those lashes?
What was that, Phyllis?
Who gives those lashes?
Beistin, the court. So the Jewish court meets it out. It can't just be any random person who wants to do it. But if we have a little extra time at the end, we'll ask the question about what do we do nowadays in terms of Makos? Is there a modern-day manifestation, given that we don't do corporal punishment in modern day Batei Dinim? Because by the way, we do have a class for the shul coming up in February. Rabbi Shlomo Weissman from the Basin of America is going to come on Zoom. And one of his classes is litigation in contemporary Batei Dinim, in contemporary Jewish courts. So I'll be surprised if he says that they administer makos today. I doubt that they do that. Halakhically, you can't. But we'll explain why later. So that's exception number one in the Mishnah, that we don't turn them into Ben Grusha Ben Chalutza. The second exception in the Mishnah is as follows. Me'idin ha'obish ploni shu chayiv liglos. So there's a halacha, another one we need a little bit of background for, which is the obligation that one has to go to gullus. One has to go into exile. Now, what would make someone have to go into exile in Jewish law? Well, there is, of course, someone... What was that, Phyllis?
Committed a crime.
So let me elaborate on that. Well, someone could go into exile, for instance, if he's put in cherem, if he's excommunicated. But that's not what we're talking about here. Rather, what we're talking about here is if somebody accidentally murders someone. The case in the Torah is that you have Reuven and Shimon. They go out to their lumberjacks for a living. They go out into the woods, they're chopping wood, and they're hacking down trees, and then Shimon swings the axe, it slips out of his hand, and it impales Reuven, and Reuven dies on the spot. So Shimon, he could have been more careful, so he doesn't get off the hook, but he didn't deliberately murder Reuven. So instead, he goes into Gullus, he goes into exile, and he goes to one of the Arei Miklat, one of the cities of refuge. So here's the thing. Let's say these two witnesses, they come into Basedin, they come into the court, and they say, we saw that Reuven accidentally killed Shimon, and therefore he should go into exile. He should go to one of the Levite cities, one of the cities of refuge, where he'll have to remain for the rest of his life until the high priest dies. Otherwise, the Goalei Hadam, the family members of the person that he inadvertently killed, are actually allowed to kill him if he leaves the city. So he gets a certain punishment. He's allowed to live. We don't put him to death, but he gets a certain level of punishment that he has to live in a city of refuge until the high priest dies. Now, why do we care about when the high priest dies? What does that have to do with anything? The Gemara later on in Makos, God willing, when we get to it, will explain why that's true. But anyway, same idea over here. They do not go into exile when they falsely accuse someone of deserving to go into exile, even though they ought to get the same punishment. Why? We don't know yet. We'll learn that later in the Gemara. But the din is, they get 39 lashes instead as a generic punishment for what they committed. So that's the end of the Mishnah section. And what the Mishnah is telling us is really two exceptions to the rule of Einim Zomim, two cases of false witnesses where they do not get the punishment that they sought to mete out, which are two exceptions to the rule, which is very odd. Why do we start with two exceptions? So I'll pause for questions in a moment, but that's going to be the first question of the Gemara. So if that's bothering you, it's bothering the Gemara as well. Okay, so let me just pause. Are there any questions on the mission that we could clarify? Jenny, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing okay. I just want to, as a backup, you're saying that this is that these are exceptions to the rules, but it actually seems like it's establishing a rule that the punishment for bearing false witness is 40 lashes, regardless of what the other, like whatever the situation, is there ever a situation where someone is not going to get 40 lashes for being a false witness?
Absolutely, because okay. What we have is there's a principle in halacha, which we'll talk about, I think, when we get to about, I think on Dalet Amud Aleph, so we have a few weeks till we get there. There's a principle called Kimlei B'derabba Minei, which means, let's say I shoot an arrow at somebody and I murder them, I kill them. So I did two things with that action. One is I murdered somebody, but also I happened to have torn and ruined their clothing at the same time. So when I go to Basedin only smacks me with the stronger punishment for that one action. We categorize it not as an act of vandalism, but as an act of murder. So I would only be, if I was warned properly and there were two witnesses and there's a lot of things that have to be lined up for this to work, I'm put to death instead of, I don't have to compensate him for his family for the shirts that I tore, but I only get the death penalty instead because that's the rule of Kimlei B'derabba. So usually when witnesses, they get the punishment that they sought to mete out, that would be in lieu of the makos. But when they're not getting the punishment that they sought to testify against someone else to give that person, then we default on the generic makos. We're not going to do this inside, but for those who are looking at the Tzur Sadaf, at the formal page of Gemara, you'll look on the left, the first Tosfos in Makos deals with this whole entire question about how can makos replace the rightful punishment that they're supposed to be getting. So some say that in Hachinami, that is still fulfillment of them getting their proper punishment. But some say that in cases which a person, you just can't fulfill giving them the same punishment that they tried to give to somebody else, then makos would be sufficient because this doesn't constitute, maybe the cases in the Mishnah are actually not cases of Edim Zomim at all. They're just cases of regular perjurious witnesses. And we'll talk about that distinction also as we elaborate more in the Gemara. But I hope, does that clarify it?
Yeah, so I think what you're saying in that case where someone was accused of actually murdering someone, a conspiring witness would be murdered.
If two witnesses want right. to put someone else to death, and then they are found to be, so then the basin gives the verdict, and the two mm-hmm. witnesses are found to be false, they get the death penalty instead, right? And a court, and possibly Toso says, possibly in that case, you know, Makos getting lashes would not suffice because death penalty, of course, intuitively is higher than Makos on the scale of punishment someone could receive. Okay, I think someone else had a, Jeremy, you had a question?
I did, and this really goes back to one of the first comments that you made. The example had to do with, I think Reuven allegedly owed someone money, and two false witnesses came and said he didn't pay the money or something to that effect. And I thought you said that if they're determined to be false witnesses, they are then required to pay the money. To whom do they pay the money? Did Reuven actually have a debt? Did Reuven discharge his debt, or would the false witnesses be required to pay the debt on his behalf, or to pay the money to him that they accused him of not having paid to the creditor?
So I believe the money goes to the person that they falsely accused. We'll talk about that a little more later on, but if memory serves, it goes to the person they falsely accused. And now the question is, well, you know, this is like a really funny idea. Why do I get the punishment that I decided to, that I tried to testify and falsely give to someone else? You know, where else in the Torah do we see that? There should just be one punishment for false witnesses, maybe Makos. That's what it should be. Why is it that it conforms to whatever I attempted to give to somebody else? So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has a fantastic approach to understand this. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, I guess for those who aren't familiar, a student of the Chafetz Chaim. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says, we have to understand the chronology of what's happening in a typical court case. In a typical court case, what happens is the witnesses, they come in, they say, Reuven murdered Shimon. Then what Basin has to do is they have to do what's called Gmar Din, which means giving the verdict. The judge hits the gavel, so to speak, and says, guilty. Now you are going to be, you know, taken out to the gallows. I'll use it as an expression. Then, only then, if a second pair of witnesses comes in, can they turn the first pair into Adam Zomerman. But if Reuven actually was put to death already based on the false testimony, they would not become Adam Zomerman to receive the same punishment. They would not be put to death, but rather they would just get standard Makos for lying in court. Now, this is weird because I would think if they actually succeeded with their false testimony, right? I see all the looks over here. If they succeeded in killing somebody, then they certainly should be put to death, not just if they attempted to put somebody to death. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman explains as follows. He says, the thing is, once Beis Din gives a verdict that someone has to die, there is this verdict given by Beis Din. Now, really, it would be Reuven who's going to be put to death. But because Reuven was found to be innocent in the end of the day, and Beis Din already created a din, they already created that there is a death sentence that needs to be meted out, well, it's not going to be fulfilled by Reuven because Reuven was just found innocent. So rather, who ought to get it instead of Reuven? Well, it ought to be the false witnesses that tried to give it to Reuven. But once Reuven is already put to death based on the false testimony, there's no longer a verdict of a death penalty out there that needs to go to somebody. So then they get standard Makos instead. So I know some of you are still shaking your head saying, well, I get it. I hear the mechanics, but I'm not satisfied ethically with them getting away with that. I'm not going to be able to fully answer that in a satisfying fashion. And that's one of the enigmas of Adam Zomerman. So much so, actually, in the later Mishnah, the Tzedukim, which were another sect of Jews during the Second Temple era, they actually argued that no, only after they managed to kill Reuven do they get put to death, but not if they just attempted. So this actually, you know, maybe some of us are Tzedukim, I don't know. But, you know, that was their debate with the rabbis. Now, okay. So let's move on to the Gemara, because I think the Gemara might address a few questions that are troubling us about this Mishnah. Can't promise we'll answer all of them, but we'll answer some of them, hopefully. So here we go. Okay. Beginning of the Gemara. So remember how the Mishnah starts off asking Ketzad Edim Nasa Zomen, how do witnesses become Edim Zomen? Now again, I'm not going to translate this term over and over again. It's like a key term we're just going to remember. Edim Zomemen are perjurous, false witnesses. But when I say Edim Zomen, it doesn't just mean they're false witnesses. It means that they were found guilty after the verdict was given, but before the person they falsely accused is punished, so they get the same punishment. That's a special term, Edim Zomemen. Can I define that better before we go on? Because that's a key term we got to know. Okay. So ha ketzad ein eidim nasa zomen vayelei. Really, the Mishnah should start off saying, how do two witnesses not achieve the status of eidim zomen? Because we just listed two exceptions to the rule. It's say ein ha-eidim nasa zomen, not how do they become eidim zomen. Furthermore, va'od, second question, miktani lekaman, if God willing, we'll get there very soon, on Hey Amid Aleph, on 5a, it says, Avo Amrlahem, Heachatem Me'idim. So how did two witnesses be proved false? When the second pair comes in, they say to the first pair, how can you testify on this case? Shareba Oso Hayo Matema Yisem Imanu B'makom Ploni. You were with us in New York when you claimed that this murder took place in Los Angeles. You couldn't have seen it. Hare Elu Zomemen, they become Edim Zomemen. So the Gemara on Haman Af, the Mishnah there, tells us how witnesses become Edim Zomemen. So why are we explaining that over here? Later on is a very clear explanation, a few pages later. So what is this Mishnah trying to accomplish? Mechlal De'ela Edim Zomemen. So we're not talking about Edim Zomemen here. So this is such an odd way to start the Masechta. You would think the Masechta should tell me, what are Edim Zomemen? And then a few pages later, teach the Mishnah we just started with. It seems all out of order. However, the Gemara answers this question in one fell swoop. It tells as follows. See, does anyone know what Makos comes after in the order of Masechtos, in the order of tractates? Anyone have a Shas in front of them?
Sanhedrin, no?
Very good, David. It comes after Sanhedrin. Ah, so Makos isn't starting off fresh. Makos, you see, we had to have gone through Sanhedrin first, really. Makos, it would take us more than a year to do that. So Makos really is picking up from where Sanhedrin left off. Tana Hasam Kai. We're continuing from the Mishnah at the end of the Talmud in Sanhedrin, which says as follows, Kol ha-zomen magdimin la-osa mitza, Chutz mi zome bas kohen uboala she'ein makdimin la'osa misa elala misa acheres. So the case over there in Sanhedrin says that the case is that there's a daughter of a kohen who commits adultery. So there's an interesting status. Usually when two people commit adultery, both the woman and the man receive the same punishment. However, when a bas kohen, the daughter of a kohen, commits adultery, she gets sreifa, this is in Rashi, she gets burning, which is really the burning lead, but she gets burning as her death penalty, which is a more extreme, a higher form of capital punishment. And the adulterer, the man who committed adultery, he gets chenek, strangulation, which is still pretty bad, but not as bad as sreifa, as burning. So the witnesses, let's say Edim Zomemen, they came in, they said this daughter of a Kohen and this man, they committed adultery together. So they would not get the more extreme death penalty. They would only get chenek, they would only get strangulation like the man who committed adultery. So you could see in that case, Sanhedrin leaves off telling us that there is a case where you have two false witnesses who don't, they get one of the punishments, but they don't get the full brunt of what they tried to do to the woman by falsely accusing her. So there is already a quasi-exception to the rule of Edim Zomemen. And then our Mishnah follows through and tells us here is a complete exception to Edim Zomemen where they don't get any of the punishment that they try to falsely accuse the person of committing. That they don't get any aspect of what they falsely accused the defendant of. Elamalkus Arbayim, rather they only get 40 lashes. And then our Mishnah continues. The Gemara basically tells us what our Mishnah should sound like. Ketzad me'idin on a bish ploni shu ben grusho ben chalutza. If they falsely accuse someone of being the son of a Kohen divorcee relationship, ein omrim yaseh ben grusha ben chalutza tachtov el lokes arbayim. They don't become a ben grusha ben chalutza. They don't lose their Kohen status, but rather they only get malchus. Ah, so now I understand why this Mishnah is expecting us to have so much background knowledge. They're assuming, the rabbis were assuming, that, you know, we started from the beginning of Shas, the beginning of the Talmud, and we're walking our way through the entire Talmud, and we just finished Sanhedrin, we made a Siyum a week ago, and now we're starting Makos today. The rabbis, I guess, had a more peachier belief of how many people were going through the entire Talmud. Many people are doing Daf Yomi. I personally am not. And some of us here are, some of us here aren't. So we need to know that little bit of Sanhedrin. So there, that's the explanation. We're picking off from the end of Sanhedrin, where Sanhedrin gave us a quasi-exception to Enim Zomen, and now we follow through with two full exceptions to Enim Zomen, two people who don't get any of the punishments that they attempted to mete out to the other party. Okay.
Rabbi, I have a question. I have a question for you. On the example of the adultery, and the woman, the adulteress, who happens to be the daughter of a Kohen, gets this aggravated execution. And the false witness, and so I'm assuming that the false witness is the Aiden Zomerman is determined before she's put to death. Is that correct?
That is
so
correct.
Because if she was actually put to death, then they would get the lashes because there's already been a death, the account's been settled. But if the false witness was a woman as opposed to a man, would the woman get the aggravated death penalty, or would they get the strangulation like the male witness would get?
That's a fascinating question. So you're saying is, are the witnesses getting the lesser extreme of capital punishment because we match them to the man? They are men. So if in theory they were committing an act of adultery, they would be getting chenek. They'd be getting strangulation, not srefa, not burning. So I don't think it has to do with the gender of the witnesses per se, though that's a very good point.
Wouldn't the woman have to be a Bas Kohen also then?
Right, exactly. So
right.
I don't think it's about their personal identity. I think it's that it's basically tefasta meruba lo tefasta, which means that when I have two things, I have one thing that is extreme, but one thing that's even more extreme, the onus of proof is to give them a more extreme, a more severe punishment. And since we can only give them one, we suffice with the lower one because that's the general principle. It takes the onus of proof is to give them a stronger punishment. So since I can equally say either way, we have to lean leniently and give them a lesser punishment in that case.
Are women allowed to testify in court? Or are they allowed to be witnesses?
Oh, not in these kind of cases. There are exceptions, such as in an Aguna case, the Gemara in Yevamos talks about where a man goes to a foreign country and, you know, back in the day, he could die there for all we know. So if a woman comes back, even just one woman, one witness, one woman comes back and says, I saw that he died, whatever the causes were, in those kind of extreme cases, based in accepts female witnesses. But you are right. The general assumption in the Gemara here is that there can only be male witnesses in these cases. Modern day Bate Dinim find ways around that, but that'll be a good discussion for Rabbi Weissman during his Scholar in Residence program. Okay. Any other questions that we could address? Okay, good. I know I'm throwing a lot of material out in this first class. It's a lot of background material to give. And I will definitely try to take time at the beginning of our next session to go over some of that. And I just want to welcome people. Let me put my email here in the chat for a moment. It's rabbikurtz@casstamford.org. I spelled that right. And, you know, I want to make sure, I know some people have more experience learning Gemara, some people it's a little bit of a newer experience. I want to try to take time outside of class if people need help just understanding some of the concepts. I'm happy to make time to try to make sure we're all on the same page and progressing together as a group. Okay, so now here's the thing. we address the first question, which is, what's with this non sequitur of a Mishnah? Now, the second question that we might be wondering is, well, now that we know we're talking about two exceptions to Edom Zomimin, why are these exceptions to the rule? Meaning, if the two witnesses were Kohanim, possel that, or possel their children, possel them, disqualify them from being legitimate Kohanim, just like they tried to do to Reuven, to the defendant. If they tried sending the defendant into exile, they should be sent into exile. So it doesn't really make sense. Why are we these two exceptions to rule? I understand they're exceptions, but why? What's behind it? So tonight we'll explain why they don't become chalalim, why they don't lose their Kohen status. And then tomorrow, then next week, God willing, we'll address the second part of the Mishnah about why they don't go to exile. So moving forward in the Gemara, Menahani Mili. So where do we get this from? So there's going to be two approaches to explain why it's an exception to the rule, why they don't become disqualified from kahuna. Number one, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Amar Rishon ben Lakish, to Amar Kra, because it says in the verse that is found in Devarim, Deuteronomy, Yotes, Yotes, 19:19. As I said, our Chumash class on Sunday mornings, we covered this actually a while back, but I think while I was here with the group. It says, Vasisem lo kasher zamam lasos lachiv. It says, you shall do to the witnesses like they, zamam is really translated as conspired, as they conspired to do to the defendant. So it says to him, it says lo in Hebrew, to him. The Gemara infers, the rabbis infer from that verse, lo velo lizaro. Only the witnesses could be punished, but leave their children out of it. To them, but not to their children. So here's the thing. If we disqualify the witnesses as legitimate Kohanim, assuming that they were Kohanim as witnesses, then you're not just impacting them, but it's collective punishment of sorts. You're impacting their children for generations as well, because that means all ensuing generations will be disqualified Kohanim. You're possibly, you're disqualifying an entire line of kahuna. So now the question that I think when I taught this mission on Friday that I want to give him credit, that Henry Goldberg asked me was, wait a minute, why can't we just disqualify them but make the rule that their children don't become disqualified as well? That way everybody's happy. Well, the issue is we can't just make up new rules. V'lifsu l'didei v'lifsuhu l'zarei. The Gemara asks, why don't we just make them possel, disqualify them from kahuna, and don't disqualify their children? Well, the issue is, b'inan kasher zom lasos. We need to give them, remember Rav Elchanan's idea that there's a verdict out there? If it's not going to the falsely accused defendant, it has to go to somebody. So it has to go to the false witnesses. So we can't give them half the verdict. They have to take the complete verdict. And a complete verdict wouldn't just disqualify them. It would disqualify also their posterity as well. And if it impacts their posterity, we can't do that because lo velo lizaro, only they get punished, not their children. So that's why that they are an exception to the rule. That's why they don't become chalalim like they try to do to the defendant in the court. That's answer number one. Now, there is a second answer, but it will be refuted. And ultimately what we just said, what we just answered, is the final answer of the Gemara. But listen in, it's worth hearing why the second answer doesn't hold water. Bar Pida Omer, so we're four lines from the bottom, if you're following with the Tzur Sadaf. Bar Pida Omer, Kal Vachomer, I could introduce a fortiori. I don't think me putting it in what do you call it? Whenever Art School translates it into Latin, it doesn't really help anyone because I don't think anyone knows Latin either. But we have a Kal Vachomer. What's the Kal Vachomer? So I'm going to logically prove to you how why this is problematic, why they cannot become B'nai Grusha and B'nai Chalutza. Uma Mechalel Eino Mischalel, just as, so here's an interesting rule. The Kohen who marries a divorcee, he doesn't become disqualified from Kuhuna. He is still a legitimate Kohen. Now, it happens to be halakhically, because of what he did, halacha that's accepted is that he doesn't duchen, he doesn't do berachas kohanim, and ideally he shouldn't be serving in the temple either. but he technically still maintains his status as a Kohen. Once it's given, it's not taken away. But what he was really doing when he marries a divorcee is that any children he has from that union are going to become chalalim. They are going to become disqualified. So we have an interesting scenario where I could disqualify my children, but without really impacting myself. So that's the general case. Hamechalel eino mischalel. Just as someone who causes his children to become disqualified, but he himself doesn't become disqualified, even though you would think if anyone should become disqualified, it should be him, but that's not the case. Habalechalel, someone who just comes in an attempt to be mechalel someone, meaning the Adam Zoman who are only attempting to cause someone to become disqualified. Velo chilel, but they did not succeed in disqualifying him. Eino din shelo yischalel. Certainly they should not become chalalim then. Because if someone who accomplishes making his children chalalim doesn't become a chalal, these witnesses that only attempted to make this person, the defendant, a chalal, they shouldn't become chalalim then. That's the kal v'chomer that he makes. That's the logical inference. What was that, Dina?
Could you, Phyllis? Could you explain why the children, the father doesn't lose his status, and the children do? Why do they get punished for his marrying a grusha?
I don't have a good answer to it. If you're asking on an ethical level, it's kind of similar almost to the questions you have with Mamzerus as well, which is, you have two people who commit adultery and then they have a child from that union. The child has a status of Mamzerus, becomes a bastard in English, and he's not able to marry a regular Jewish person of regular Jewish lineage. So it's a similar issue over there. I'm not equipped to give you the ethical answer to it, but that is the accepted halacha on it. But I don't have the sources in front of me, but that is the understanding of how it works.
Yeah. So okay.
The kal v'chomer, I mean, it's a good question to ask, though. I'm not equipped to answer it properly. But the kal v'chomer here is, well, if a person who has a child could turn him into a disqualified Kohen, but he himself doesn't become disqualified, witnesses that merely attempt to make someone disqualified, certainly they shouldn't become disqualified themselves. That's the kal v'chomer of the Gemara. I don't have a better translation for kal v'chomer other than the Latin, so you'll forgive me, but I think we understand the logic, hopefully. So that's his proof. That's why the witnesses can never become disqualified, because they're only attempting to disqualify somebody else. Now, here's the thing, though. Remember what we just talked about for Adam Zoman, how Adam Zoman work? Remember Adam Zoman, that they only attempt to cause someone to get a punishment, but they don't actually succeed? Well, the issue with this kal v'chomer is that it basically uproots the entire basis of what Adam Zoman are. Adam Zoman, by very definition, attempt to do something to somebody else, and they get that verdict instead. So this kal v'chomer doesn't work because it destroys the whole basis of the definition of what Adam Zoman are predicated on. Adam Zoman, by definition, attempt to do something, and they get punished for what they attempted to do. So the Gemara says, Maskiflo Rabina in Cain, Bitalta Toras Adam Zomaman. You have just contradicted the entire basis of Adam Zoman. This kal v'chomer is unacceptable. Why? Because then it's a reductio ad absurdum. I could use it in any case then. Think about it. Uma Hasokel, turning to the next page. Congratulations. We just finished an Amud Gemara. We're going to go a little bit more, two to three lines, onto Beis Amud Beis, to the two dots to finish it. So Uma Hasokel Eino Niskal, Adam Zoman, that attempt to cause someone to receive the verdict of stoning, but they do not succeed. Haboliskol below Sakal, Eino Din Shalo Yisakel. So if the witnesses succeed in causing someone to be to receive death penalty by stoning, if they succeed, they don't get punished. I can make a kal v'chomer, which is, I'm sure, what everyone would be happy with, which is if they only attempt to cause someone to get stoning as a punishment, certainly they shouldn't be put to death. They shouldn't receive skila. Now, that sounds like a wonderful kal v'chomer. If you don't get punished for succeeding. You shouldn't get punished for attempting to do something bad to somebody. But that's not what how Adam Zomerman work. For whatever reason, I gave Rebel Chanan Wasserman's approach, which resonates with me. There's other approaches as well. So you can't use a Kal Vachomer like that because that whole logic repudiates what Adam Zomerman is all about. Therefore, rather, the first answer makes more sense. The first answer is clear. And the reason that the Gemara concludes in the end of the day why witnesses, why Adam Zomerman do not receive, do not become disqualified the same way they tried to disqualify the defendant from becoming a Ben Grusha Ben Chalutza, certainly, so too, that is the reason because lo v'lo lazaro, the reasoning in the end of the day is because they only they could be punished, not their children. Their children can't receive the punishment that they intended to mean out to someone else. Only they deserve to get that verdict that they attempted to do. And therefore, they only get Malkus. They get 39 generic lashes instead, which, by the way, I mean, I've never received actual Malkus, but later on in the Masechta, we talk about it, and it's pretty painful. In fact, actually, I'll tell you something. Later on in the Masechta, it says, actually, that people were so afraid, they were shaking in fear of getting Malkus, that if someone soils themselves while they're being brought out, they actually get exempted from a Makos because they went through such humiliation and fear and pain and going, you know, just being brought to the post where they're going to be whipped. That all, already fulfills the punishment for them. So that's, you know, Makos is a pretty harsh punishment. So when I say they get off with the generic 39 lash, it's like, they're not getting off the hook, you know, maybe becoming disqualified. I mean, I'm not going to start weighing what's better, what's worse, but it's not like they're getting off the hook either. So I wouldn't worry in that regard. So,
but they don't die.
They do not die. Well, if they try to cause someone to receive the death penalty, then they would be put to death. That's just not the case we're dealing with here. We're dealing with exceptions to the rule. That'd be a regular case. But, so first, I just want to wish, you know, this is a milestone. We already achieved a milestone that we just finished our first Amud of Gemara, and we made our way onto the second Amud of Gemara. So just a definition of terms, right? So you have the Gemara over here. So this is one side is an Amud, and then when I refer to a full page, which is both sides, that's a daf, or in Yiddish, a blot of Gemara. So I'll try to translate that, but those are also some good key terms to remember as we go forward. I do have one more thing I wanted to share, but I just want to pause and take questions. Is there anything I could clarify just on the Gemara itself? Okay. I hope it's like because I'm being clear and not because it's so unclear we don't even have questions. But I want to share one question, which is, so here's the thing. Because we don't have a Sanhedrin that's sitting on Har Habayis, it's sitting in the temple precincts, and we don't have Jewish law in all of its glory, we're in exile today. One of the things that Beis Din cannot do is Beis Din, a Jewish court, cannot mete out penalties or corporal punishment. I'm sure that's, you know, a lot of us are pretty relieved about that, but that is the case. So here's the thing. Let's say I committed a sin which would make me incur 39 lashes. And because there's no Beis Din around today to give me 39 lashes, but I want to do teshuvah, I want to atone for my sin, is there a way for me to achieve teshuvah and atone for my sin in lieu of the makos that Beis Din would have given me otherwise? So Erwin and I were talking about this earlier today. There's this minhag. I've never done it myself, but the Torah mentions, this is the code of law preceding the Shulchan Aruch, that on Erev Yom Kippur, mincha before Yom Kippur, people would have a custom to give each other lashes. So now the lashes, usually, it's never like a full, like, you know, one guy with a whip who's lashing a guy with all of his might. It's usually like, you know, like little taps, which is more of a zecher. It's more of a way to remember the days of yore when we used to receive actual lashes. But the question is, can someone willingly accept makos today in order to atone for a sin that they committed? So what's interesting, Diuk, the base Yosef and the Darkei Moshe talk about it, but the Hagos Kiryas Chana, he notes that the commentary, the Magen Avraham says that the whipping that one gets at Mincha time on the eve of Yom Kippur doesn't atone for any sins. Now, why doesn't it atone for any sins? Well, the Magen Avraham makes it sound like because you weren't doing it with all of the specifications and all the full brute force that you would have gotten from an actual, genuine, authentic base, which the Kiryas Chana derives from there. He infers, so if nowadays I were to set it up, you get the special whip that we'll describe later on toward the end of Makos, and I have someone with full force whipping me on the back and forth, 39 lashes, all three places that they're supposed to do, that would count as if the Beis Din gave it to me. So when Hashem on Yom Kippur is deciding whether I've successfully atoned for my sins, that would actually count. So I guess it's a matter of practical urbanics. I'm not advising this, and we will not be doing it on a Good Hashem campus. I think, Toby, you could agree with me on that, right? We're not doing any public whippings at a Good Hashem.
No, it's not on the Jewish calendar.
I know we're very open tent and we're very open to many different opinions and ways to practice your Judaism, but that's not one of the things we'll be doing here. But I think it's very interesting to note that is something out there. It's a question, which is these institutions that we are learning about now, they don't exist. They don't manifest themselves the regular way today. So the question is, how do I make this applicable to me today? So I don't advise people trying to make it applicable in a practical sense, because that could be quite painful and probably not done right. Don't try this at home, but it's something to think about as we go through the Masechta. Okay.
Why couldn't a suggestion be, instead of Mako, to give money to tzedakah or...
Very good. So
something that helps the other person.
So in Chashuki Chemet over here, which is a great sefer by Rav Zilberstein, which I just told you this idea from, he actually cites a few sources which say nowadays you give tzedakah, you give charity in lieu of that, which is a really great catch-all, because you know how everyone, there's a misnomer out there that, God forbid, a Torah scroll, a sefer Torah falls, we have to fast for it. But actually, we kind of just give tzedakah, a significant amount of tzedakah, I don't know, a specified amount per se, and that also counts in lieu of the fasting that in theory we would have done. So tzedakah is like a really great way I don't want to say get out, because you're supposed to give a significant amount, but it can be given in lieu of the makos that you would have otherwise gotten. Toby?
So, you know, just from what we learned from this first Amud, you know, you see that Aiden Zomamin applied to situations involving status. And you made reference to, you know, if somebody ended up being killed. But what if the punishment, let's say there was a monetary dispute, would Adim Zomamin play a role there as well? In other words, let's say the punishment ended up being, well, you've got to pay so-and-so money. And then you find out that this was false. So couldn't you then just get the money back and, you know, make the, in other words, would the first person get the money back?
Oh, well, if he already...
Let's say if he had paid it to the person who they decided you owe him money. And now it turns out he didn't owe you money.
So what you're bringing up is a discussion among the commentaries, which is, well, you know, when it comes to a death penalty or comes to makos, once makos are given, once a death penalty is administered, a person is executed, that's not something that's reversible.
Right, but money is.
The money is reversible. So that's all right. That question is raised, I believe, among the Rishonim. But I think the general understanding is once he already pays Shimon the money, then that already constitutes following through on the judgment. So that's already post. It's not just the verdict was given at that point, but the punishment was considered meted out at that point as well. That's the general understanding.
Then what happens to the Adim Zomamin?
So the Adim Zomamin, they would get so the money would be returned to the rightful owner of the money, and then the witnesses would receive Malkus.
Okay.
Right, and then the witnesses would receive Malkus. They would get Malkus, Makos, same idea, same word, basically.
Why wouldn't they just have to pay money?
Because it, because it has to be in that sweet spot, that window where the basin gave the verdict, but it didn't yet administer the punishment or make sure that the defendant followed through on the verdict. So once the verdict is followed through, then the witness says it's kasher usa at that point. It's not that they attempted at that point. They already succeeded in causing Reuven to give Shimon the money. Is that a, or am I not addressing the question?
I'm not sure. I may just not be understanding. I have to think about it.
Okay. There's a lot to think about over here. Oh, Judd, I see you raising your hand.
Yeah, just a curiosity. The pasuk that's quoted from the Torah is in the singular. It says, Vasisim lo.
Well, Vasisim is
not Lohem.
Lo is to the defendant.
It says, Vasisim lo kasher zamam lo.
Right, like they attempted to do to him.
Yeah, but lo is singular.
Lo is referring to the defendant.
The defendant. Oh, okay.
This is what they attempted to do to him, the defendant. Oh no, okay, I see what you're saying. Vasisim lo kasher zamam lasusah. Right, they would do to him. Oh, sorry, my mistake. Right, vasisim lo kasher zamam lasusah. Right, so it uses that particular formulation to specifically teach us the lo velo lazaro distinction, that it's to him, not to his children.
Right. Lehem means him and his children.
So that's the exclusion of children.
I mean, it's just that they're referring to Adam Zomamin as just one aid.
Okay. So what's important here also is that, you know, each witness, so you would think, one of the important points from that verse is that you would think, so let's say they get the 39 lashes, right? They accused Reuven of committing a sin that he would incur 39 lashes. So I would think, oh, let's let the two witnesses split up the 39 lashes. So no, you can't do that. Rather, each individual one needs to receive the full brunt of the punishment. So it's important that not that they as a unit aren't receiving the punishment, but each and every one receives the full brunt of the punishment himself. So each one as a singular person receives that full punishment. I think that's one of the derivations that's made from the fact that it says lo. Okay. All right. We are at 8:30. It's been an hour. It's been a great hour. So if anyone has any further questions, feel free to email me. Feel free to reach out. And please always feel free to reach out with feedback. This is our first class. I'm open to figuring out better ways to do this and make sure. Oh, yeah, Toby?
Yeah, I think you need to put your address in the to everyone. I think
I accidentally. You messaged me. So I accidentally.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me put it in the chat.
Toby, mazel tov.
Thank you.
Okay. How's everybody?
Thank God. Wonderful. Baruch Hashem.
Good.
Okay. My email is in the chat, rabbikurtz@cs-stanford.org. Go welcome to reach out. And so now it's not 48 weeks anymore. Now it's 47. And God willing, it'll fly by really fast. And as I said, we keep at this pace. At about this time next year, we'll be finishing the entire Masechta together, God willing. All right, Yasher Koch, everyone.
Thank you
for coming. Have a great day.
Thank you very much.